Okay, let's get started, everyone. This is our last class in this series. Before we start, I just want to add that this class is dedicated by Howard Okrent's family in his memory on his fifth yahrzeit. So I want to start with that. And also, of course, as with all our classes, this class is in the merit of all of our soldiers who are fighting for their refuah shleima of all of the wounded and for the immediate return of all of the hostages and peace in Eretz Yisrael. So we are in
Awesome.
our final class. We're going to do a kind of a grab bag of different ideas about protecting the land, Jewish sources about our connection to the land and ecology and environment, and Israeli innovation. And the picture here, which is a beautiful picture of bird migration, is because we're going to see that the Chula Valley, which is a center of bird migration, was really one of the catalysts for modern nature preservation in Israel. But one of the things that I think is important to remember when we talk about ecology and environment in the land of Israel and stewardship of the land, and this has been something that has been kind of echoing throughout all of our classes, the existence of Am Yisrael in the diaspora for 2,000 years, to a great extent, separated us from the land. Hey, there were Jews who were farmers in various diaspora communities. It's not true that there were no Jewish farmers, but in general, even if we were connected to the land in the Galut, we were not connected to the land in Eretz Yisrael in a physical sense. We became much more detached. We became much more people of the book and not people of the land. And with our return to Eretz Yisrael in the last 120, 150 years, we are coming back to that deep and organic connection between the Jewish people and the land, and that's going to be one of the things that we're going to touch on today. Okay, so if you talk about, ecology, environment, connection to the land, the holiday that first comes to mind, I think, is Tu B'Shvat. In general, our year cycle is very much connecting to the land. But Tu B'Shvat is really a very easy example for it. Tu B'Shvat begins as kind of an accounting. It's a tax idea, right? When do you start to count the various mitzvot that take place that connect to the trees? When do you consider the fruit to be of this year and not of that year? You need to have a date. So you say Tu B'Shvat, and that's what we have here in the Mishnah and Rosh Hashanah. There are four new years. On the first of Nisan is the new year for kings and for festivals. On the first of Elul is the new year for animal tithes, right? Which animals, what year are they born in, depends on which animals go to the Beit HaMikdash in what year. The first of Tishrei is the new year for years, right? That's what we do today. Sabbatical years and jubilee years, right? We do Shemitah, connected to Tishrei, for planting, for tithing vegetables. On the first of Shvat is the new year for the tree, in accordance with the statement of Beit Shammai. Okay, and again, when do we start counting in terms of Orla, right? The 4 years that we're not allowed to eat fruit. So when does that year begin? And other mitzvot that are connected to fruit, we connect it with, well, according to Beit Shammai, Rosh Chodesh Shvat, but we follow Beit Hillel. The new year for trees is on the 15th year of Shvat. 15th of Shvat. Now, what began as essentially an accounting idea throughout the centuries, Tu B'Shvat kind of evolved and took on different costumes based on what was significant to the Jewish people at the time. And I actually have a whole class on the evolution of Tu B'Shvat. We are not going to talk about that now. We haven't even gotten to Hanukkah. We're definitely not up to Tu B'Shvat. But it is interesting to notice that if you look at advertisements that come out around Tu B'Shvat now in the last few decades, right? Lectures or celebrations or what synagogues are doing, a lot of it is very much connected to the environment and to ecology. And it's taking back, going back to very old Jewish ideas, but putting them in the guise of let's talk about this on Tu B'Shvat. But what are those ideas that we talk about that does the Torah really encourage us to take care of our environment? Of what's around us? Or is it this idea that, God created man and said, the world belongs to you, right? And we'll come back to this at the end as well. But even early on, when we have those psukim in Breshit about how you have to take over the world, right? Redu ba'aretz v'kivshuha, to conquer the world, we also have an idea that is where I took the title for this class from. Okay, if you look at the first pasuk here, Vayikach Adonai Elohim et ha'adam, Vayanicheu b'gan Eden le'ovda u'lishomra. The Lord God took man and placed him in the Garden of Eden to till it and to tend it. Right, one of the jobs of Adam HaRishon, of the first man, is to take care of the Garden of Eden. It's not just that he's given this gift, but he has to actually take care of it. It has to be, it's one of his responsibilities. And we have this beautiful midrash, Kohelet Rabbah, which is cited in a lot of places in terms of taking care of the land. When the Blessed Holy One created the first human, he took him and led him all around the trees of the Garden of Eden and said to him, look at my works, how beautiful and praiseworthy they are. And all that I have created, it was for you that I created. Pay attention that you do not corrupt and destroy my world. If you corrupt it, there is no one to repair it after you. So this very, we would think of this as a very modern, right? We have to sustainability and we have to protect the world. This is from the Midrash, from centuries upon centuries upon centuries ago. And we could even go back to this idea in the Torah again, right? It's not only that you have to work the land and you have to take care of the land, but you have to be careful not to destroy. Okay? And one of the rules of war that we have in Sefer Dvarim, okay? Sefer Dvarim, we have a whole list of rules of war. I see I have a mistake here, but I'll fix it later. When in your war against a city, you have to besiege it a long time in order to capture it. You must not destroy its trees, wielding the axe against them. You may eat of them, but you must not cut them down. Are trees of the field human to withdraw before you into the besieged city? Right? This is one way to explain this pasuk. It's not such a clear pasuk, but it says, Adam etz hasadeh. So you could say, are trees human? Other people will interpret it as people are like the trees of the field. But in terms of the halakha, in terms of the law, here's the Rambam. A fruit-bearing trees must not be cut down outside of a besieged city, nor do we block their irrigation, causing the trees to dry up. As it says, do not destroy her trees, right? That should say 21. Anyone who cuts down the trees receives slashes. This is not only at times of a siege, but anyone at any time who chops down a fruit tree for destructive purposes receives stripes, receives lashes. The tree may be cut down if it is damaging other trees or damaging another's field, or because the tree is more valuable for its wood than its fruit. The Torah only forbids wanton destruction. And from this, we have the idea of Baal Tashchit, right? That you can't just destroy things because you feel like destroying them. You have to preserve the environment, nature, the world. You have to take care of it. So these are some early ideas that we have about preservation, sustainability, right? All these kind of modern buzzwords, but we have them much earlier on. Now, if we want to go back to the idea of kind of steward of the land, you have the idea of Shemitah, right? Shemitah resting on the sabbatical year, right? What's the concept behind it? So some people will say, well, it's because it's good for the land, but ultimately the Torah idea of Shemitah is whether it's good for the land or not good for the land is the idea that the land does not belong to you. ultimately, the land belongs to God. We are only stewards of the land. Right? Now, the idea of not working the land in a sabbatical year was very, very theoretical for a long time. Even in the time of the Gemara, right? We have an idea that if the tax burden is very, very heavy, if it's very difficult financially to keep Shemitah, you don't have to do it today. And certainly, when Jews lived in the diaspora, and there was only a very small number percentage of Jews living in Eretz Israel, you did not have these rules. Nobody was keeping these rules of Shemitah. But what happens with the first Aliyah, with Jews coming back? Jews always live in the land of Israel, but we don't have so many farming communities. But with Jews returning in the 1880s with the first Aliyah, there's suddenly a realization, what are we going to do about Shemitah? How is this going to work? Because remember that the first Aliyah is largely very, very traditional Jewish families. Okay? Second Aliyah is much more people who came from traditional families, but they themselves were not religious. But the first Aliyah, most of them were very religious, and they did not know what to do. And in 1888, as they start to look ahead to the upcoming year, Shemitah year of 1889, the Jews of Gedera, the farmers of Gedera, one of the early settlements, write to the rabbis in Europe and they say, what should we do? Now, in order to understand why this is such a crisis for them, you have to understand that these early Jewish colonies, places like Gedera and Zichron Yaakov and Rishon LeZion and Mazkeret Batya that we're going to talk about, they were living hand to mouth. They had nothing. Their crops were not flourishing. It was very, very difficult. They really were on the brink of starvation. They had to turn to Baron Rothschild to bail them out. And suddenly to say to them, you can't farm for a year, that was a death sentence. What are they going to do? So they write to Europe. They write to the rabbi of Kovno, one of the great rabbis of Europe in the 19th century, Rabbi Yitzchak Elchanan Spector. And he thinks about the question, and then he gives a very limited heter, right? A way to get around the Shemitah. And it's what we call heter mechira, and it's still in use today in various versions, right? As the Shemitah year is approaching, if we forbid working the land, the colonies will be destroyed. Hundreds will die of starvation. In order to save these souls and to save the settlement project, to save body and money, we have found a way to permit work for this year, right? It's very limited. It's not something that you can take as a blanket approval. It's for this Shemitah. Next Shemitah, we'll figure out something else. By selling the land and the vineyards to non-Jews, right? We have this kind of a, I don't want to call it a fiction, but a legal loophole where if the land doesn't belong to Jews, then you can work the land with the condition that they are returned after the sabbatical year when we return the deposit money. Obviously, those colonists who can hire non-Jewish workers to farm the land should do so, but the poor may work the land themselves based on the ruling of the rabbinical court in Jerusalem. This is the second caveat. Caveat number one, very temporary. Caveat number two, this is based on the approval of the Yishuv Hayashan, of the rabbis who are in Jerusalem. If they agree, then this is something that is binding. If not, not. All this is said only about the upcoming sabbatical year, not for others that will follow it. Okay, so what happens? You get this Heter Mechira. All of the colonies are very excited. They're very pleased. Baron Rothschild is very pleased. He doesn't have to give more money. Except what happens? The rabbis of the old Yishuv do not accept this. Okay, the Ashkenazi rabbis, the Sephardi rabbis do, the Ashkenazi rabbis do not. But almost all of the communities follow it anyway because they know that they don't have any alternative. There's only one community that does not, and that is one that happens to have been very close to Baron Rothschild's heart, but no longer. This is a community that he names after his mother. It's originally called Kiryat Ekron, but he names it Mazkeret Batya after his mother Betty. She's the glamorous lady in the middle. She is not one of the early pioneers. Right? This is a community that is actually founded by farmers who come from Pavlova in White Russia, unlike a lot of the other communities where people came and they really didn't know what they were doing. These guys really were farmers. They came, they picked out good land, they started to work the land, they found water, the well. This is all in the restored community of Maskarabatya today. They had an experimental farm. That's a picture you have up here on the right, where they grew different kinds of crops. They were eventually able to build a beautiful synagogue, but they refused to accept the Heter Mechira. They say, we're not going to farm the land. And Baron Rothschild is very, very angry with them. He cuts them off. He doesn't give them any money. They manage to survive through money that's given to them by the Shemitah fund that is created in Jerusalem. Okay. But they really become the black sheep. But later on, communities that decide that they want to hold up the flag of Shemitah observance, they turn to Maskarabatya. This is really, we're not going to go more into the Shemitah story. There's another controversy in the early 20th century with Rav Kook, but I do want to read one last source. This is a source from a rabbi named Rabbi Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin, the Netziv, one of the very, very important rabbis in Europe, one of the supporters of the Zionist Project. He's part of the Chovei Tzion, of the Lovers of Zion. He believes in the Zionist Project, but he says, at what cost, right? We want to move back to the land of Israel, but we want to keep its character as a Jewish state. And he says things that I think are still very important to us today. The land of Israel is still holy today, and the spirit of the Torah is why it survives. Just like the existence of Israel among the nations is because of keeping the Torah. A piece of land is not the reason for our survival. Judaism is our land and our existence. And we must understand that we are not here to settle the land of the Philistines, but to settle souls in a land holy to God and to Israel, his people. And the question really is, at what cost do we have a Jewish state? And how do we deal with these laws, which in the diaspora were a dead letter? And now suddenly we come back here, and how do we do them and keep them while keeping our state going? And that, of course, is a semester-long class and not one that I am going to teach. But I did want to bring up the idea of Shemitah because I really do think it's important in understanding our connection and how we feel about the land according to the Torah. But let's get into modern Israel a little bit. So great cartoon here on the right, right? What is the little Israeli character carrying? He's carrying this huge burden that's called Aliyah Chadasha, right? The new Olim. Israel, in the first few years of its existence, in the first 5 years, doubles its population. A incredible challenges of absorbing thousands and thousands and thousands of new immigrants every year, every month, thousands of new immigrants. And because of that, the preservation and natural resources did not take first priority in the beginning. And even then, there still are some large steps that are taken in the beginning, but we can understand why it doesn't happen right away in that first decade. Just if you want to know what the caption is, Yisrael, ze ktzat kaved aval na'im. It's a little bit heavy, this burden, but it's pleasant, right? And that was the approach that we want to accept all these new immigrants. But what do we do? How do we have a timeline here of protecting our natural resources? So the British Mandate already comes in. And does something very important. Last time we talked about animals, we talked about how a lot of animals were hunted to extinction and they had been in the land of Israel even up until the late 19th century. But the just crazy hunting and hunting into extinction. So the British Mandate comes along, makes a law against hunting certain animals. Already in 1926, Alexander Eig, who we talked about when we talked about plants, right? The guy who starts the botanical gardens in the Hebrew University, calls for an organization to protect nature. The British Mandate protects forests. But in the state of Israel, we have the beginnings of the Society for the Protection of Nature in 1953. We'll see what was the catalyst for that. Okay. In 1955, of Knesset law to protect wildlife. 63, a law against picking wildflowers becomes incredibly successful. And in 1964, the Nature Authority is founded and we have the first nature reserves. Okay, so we're going to explore all these different things. I just wanted us to have a little bit of a timeline, survey of ancient trees from the 90s and on, and the parks authorities and the reserves are united into Rishon LeZion of HaGanim in 1998. Okay, not so important, kind of bureaucratic, but nice to know. Okay, our story begins with the Chula Valley. Sorry, what was that? Oh, okay. We'll come back to it. All right. Well, our story begins with the Chula Valley. The Chula Valley is a very interesting situation. Okay? If you drive up north towards Kiryat Shmona, a hot spot today, unfortunately, you are driving through a very large plain, but it's not really a plain. It's more like a bowl. Because on your, if you're driving north, okay, on your left to the west, you have a mountain range called the Naphtali Mountain Range, Mamot Naphtali. On your right to the east, you have the Golan Heights. And in between, you have this flat area that's called the Chula Valley. Now, because it's kind of like this bowl that has mountain ranges on both sides, the topography of it meant that water was trapped. Right, water was trapped there. There was a ridge of basalt in the south, and water was trapped there. And in ancient times, and up until very recently, this was a lake. Right? And in fact, Josephus talks about the Chula Sea, Yam HaChula, or the Chulata. Right? It was not, not a major lake, but it was still a lake and very swampy, but good for grazing, good for raising cotton. In ancient times, they raised rice here, papyrus. You can see here catching fish, this great picture over here on the left. But there was a lot of neglect of this area in the Ottoman period. There were more swamps. Swamps, of course, lead to mosquitoes. Mosquitoes lead to malaria. And with more and more Jewish settlement in the Galilee, in the early 50s, a decision is made to drain the swamps so that you could have more farmland. Okay? And this was an enormous JNF project in the 1950s. It took a good part of the decade to drain these swamps, and in order to create the beautiful farmland that you are seeing here. However, there were some voices, even in all this progress and Israel's moving forward in the 1950s, it was all about where are we going to put all these new immigrants and how are we going to feed all these new immigrants, right? And more farmland was, of course, the most important thing. But there were still lone voices here and there who are saying, but wait a second, maybe this is a natural resource that if you destroy it, you're really going to be destroying something much larger. You're destroying a whole ecosystem. And the results of these few voices crying out were, number one, there was a small area of the Chula Valley that was retained as a nature reserve, Shmirat HaChula. And more significantly, the SPNI, the Society for the Protection of Nature in Israel, Chevra Lahagana HaTeva, was founded in order to protect other areas, even though this was done. Now, the Chula, the story turns out to be kind of more, sorry. Oh, no. Yes. Okay. So we have, the first national parks. The very first national park is the Chula. And this beginning of the SPNI. Okay. And we'll come back to that in a second, but Mother Nature kind of has the last laugh. And it turned out that draining the Chula was not such a good idea. Okay. Because number one, when the Chula was drained and they tried to bring in all this agriculture, it turned out that the soil was not so great for agriculture. It might have been good for rice, it might have been good for papyrus, but it wasn't necessarily good for growing wheat. Okay. Not only that, but you had peat that was decomposing, that was flowing into the Kinneret that was harming it. And most significantly, the whole ecosystem of this wetlands was destroyed. And that meant you had much less biodiversity, especially in terms of birds. Okay. Birds and bird migration. This was a very important stop for bird migration. And when it was dried up, then that dried up as well. So in 1990, Israel took the very unusual step of reflooding part of the Hula Valley, and they created something called the Hula Lake, the Agmon HaChula, right? So today there are two sites. There's the Shmurat HaChula, the original nature reserve, and then next to it, not far from it, is the Agmon HaChula, the Hula Lake. Plants and animals that had disappeared were reintroduced. There was food that was put out for birds so that they would start to return to there. And today it's become this amazing migrating center. So it's really a very interesting thing at what we do with nature and what are the consequences. And they're not exactly always what we think they're going to be. But one of the consequences that was important was that the Society for the Protection of Nature in Israel was founded. It was founded by two activists, Azaria Alon and Amot Zahavi, in 1953. Of course, the Society for the Protection of Nature is still around today. They are probably most famous, even though it's not the most important thing they do, but they are probably most famous for sponsoring hikes and educational programs. They have a number of field schools in Israel, and they're very much identified with all kinds of getting out into the land and who you're going to call. You're going to call the Chevra Lahagana HaTeva, and they're going to take you places. But really, they do much more than that. They take upon themselves the job of protecting the Kinneret, protecting rivers from pollution, air pollution, very important job of protecting the coasts. Okay, that the coasts, the beaches should stay clean and should stay public. They pushed that there should be a law, which was finally passed, to have public access to beaches, because for a long time, private developers were buying up areas on beaches and building their own hotels, skyscrapers, and limiting public access to beaches. So SPNI was very involved in stopping that, okay? As well as creating parks and centers of nature in urban areas. Okay? One of the places they're involved in is a beautiful small little park right next to the Knesset called the Jerusalem Bird Observatory, where you can come. It's literally in the middle of the city, and you can come and you can watch dozens of species of birds just coming into the area there, and they do all kinds of wonderful things. Their symbol is one of the famous protected species, the Gilboa iris. Okay. And just to translate what it says here, the Chevra Lahagana HaTeva, the Society for the Protection of Nature, Shomrim Mechanchim Ohavim. We guard, we educate, and we love, okay, the land, obviously, or nature. So as we said, one of the activists who was very much part of this fight for the Hula and then creating SPNI was Azaria Alon, who just passed away not too long ago. Azaria Alon was not born in Israel, but he came as a child. His parents brought him here from the Ukraine. He lived in the Jezreel Valley almost his whole life. He lived in Beit HaShita, very important kibbutz in the Jezreel Valley. And from a very young age, he was involved with nature. He loved nature. He hiked everywhere. In the time of the British, where it wasn't permitted to go to a lot of places, he was arrested by the British for hiking. He went up to the Hermon and he hiked. He was arrested by the Syrians. Right? Once Israel became a state, the hiking wasn't forbidden, but he kept on doing it. And he wrote many books on nature and geography. He edited an encyclopedia of flora and fauna in Israel. And he is in the Guinness Book of World Records for having the longest running radio program, a program called The Landscape of Our Land from 1959, pretty much almost till he died. One of the, and he was very involved in all sorts of causes of preservation of nature in Israel. One of them is the reason why we have these pictures of bottled water from Ein Gedi. Ein Gedi, as we're going to see in a minute, is one of the nature reserves in Israel. An oasis with the beautiful natural springs. Kibbutz Ein Gedi, which is founded in the early years of the state, started to bottle the water from the springs, from Nachal Arugot. And Azaria Alon led the fight against this and said, this water doesn't belong to the kibbutz. This water belongs to the whole country. This water is a natural treasure. They came to some sort of an agreement, but he really did fight against it and say, this is not the kibbutz's water. This is a water that is a part of the property of the state of Israel, of the land of Israel. Here you can see him as a young man. He's photographing the chatzav, which we talked about a couple of times ago as one of these harbingers of the fall. Okay, so that's Azaria Alon. National parks. Okay, so national parks, originally there were two bodies. One was the Parks Authority, which was involved in places that were preserving history and tourism, and the other was the nature reserve, Shmorot HaTeva, which was more about, nature and natural landmarks. They were united in the 1990s. Today there are, and I'm giving an approximate number because there were new ones that were created recently and I didn't find a good current figure, but over 80 national parks, 490 nature reserves in Israel. Okay. They are different. They're different types. So you have ones that focus mostly on the beauty of nature, right? Natural beauty. And a couple of examples that I brought you here. The middle one, of course, is En Gedi, Nachal David, one of the real early nature reserves, very, very important, preserving natural oasis in the desert. On the left here, you have the Madrasa or Nachal Dilayot, one of the riverbeds that empties into the Kinneret. And on the right, of course, is Rosh HaNikra, which is a different kind of a nature reserve on the coast with this amazing rock formation. You also have the Parks Authority also works to preserve archaeology. And you have a lot of historic sites and archaeological sites that are national parks. Okay? Masada, everybody knows, right? That's the picture on the right. Maybe a little less well known. Also one of the very, very beautiful parks that combines both of these elements, both nature and history, is Tel Dan. Right? Tel Dan is one of the River Dan is one of the source waters of the Jordan. It is incredibly beautiful nature and a whole ecosystem in the park, but there's also very, very important archaeology of the ancient city of Laish and then the Israelite city of Dan. And this picture here is a discovery that was made almost 20 years ago, I think, of the oldest preserved archway in the world. Okay? This is an arch that was preserved by luck only because it was closed up at some point and they made a different entrance to the city. But it goes back to the Bronze Age, right? This goes was called the Abrahamic Gate because it goes back to the time of Abraham. And you can see it's a beautiful arch made out of mud bricks over 1,000 years before anybody thought that arch technology had come to the world. Okay, the final thing we'll talk about with national parks is what's been happening in the parks in the last decade, maybe a little bit more than that, but really it's grown enormously in the past decade, and that is a push towards accessibility. Now, obviously, certain places cannot be made completely accessible. We're talking about nature here or archaeological sites, but the parks have really worked very hard to create at least some kind of accessibility so that people in wheelchairs can come and enjoy some of the beauty of these places, even if they can't get to the whole park. And it really has grown by leaps and bounds. So some of the examples here on the left is Masada. You could take the cable car up to the top of Masada and you can really see, you have to be pretty strong to push a wheelchair, but you can really see a lot of Masada. On the right here is the park in Tel Dan, right? Which much of it is not accessible, but there is a whole part that you can enter with a wheelchair or a stroller in the beginning, and you can see some of the beauty of the park. And this one in the middle is my favorite one because it's, well, first of all, I really like the site, but also it's just a crazy site to make accessible, and they were able to do it, and that's Herodian. Okay? Herodian, the mountain fortress built by Herod in the Judean desert. Amazing, amazing discoveries. Up until a year and a half ago, it was really completely inaccessible, very, very difficult if you couldn't walk well. And now there's this whole pathway that you can take, not to the entire place, but to a lot of it. And it's really an amazing accomplishment. Okay. One of the really successful campaigns of the Society for the Protection of Nature was to get a law passed in the Knesset in 1963 to protect flowers. Now, what's the big deal, right? Israel has lots of flowers because in the early days of Zionism, people would go out to the forests and the fields. And one of the ways to show how much they love nature was to pick flowers, because flowers are beautiful. Let's bring them home. What a beautiful Zionist idea. And nature was being loved to death. Really, people would go into the forest and they would pick all of the kalaniyot, right? Or all of the rakafot. And that was it. There were no flowers. And so there was this idea that we're going to create certain species that are protected species, right? And protected wildflowers, which is very nice. And normally would be a law that would pass and then nobody would think about it. But the amazing thing here is that there was a whole public relations campaign that was launched and was amazingly successful, with posters and with card games and with lottery tickets with pictures of flowers and with a slogan, "Se lanof fa'al tiktof," go out to the wilderness, but don't pick flowers. And today, if you go out on a hike and you start to pick a flower, I can guarantee you that every Israeli from age 3 and up will come running up to you and say, "Don't pick the flowers." Hey, nobody picks the flowers. And it really is an amazing thing. It was an amazing, successful public relations campaign. So just before we get to one last element of it, I just want to point out the different flowers that are here. The anemones, the kalaniyot, of course, are very well known. Kalaniyot, and today we think about them because they are the symbol of the South, right? The Darom Adom, these beautiful beds of red flowers that bloom in the Negev in February. In the middle are what are called turmusim, lupines. Very, very beautiful flowers, only grow in certain places, and for a very short time in the year. When you go see them, they're spectacular. And on the right is a flower that's much more humble, and it kind of grows everywhere, and it can grow in the most adverse conditions out of rocks. And in January, February, you'll see forests are carpeted with them. These are cyclamen or rakafot. And they're very humble in a way. And there's a beautiful song that's become very popular in the last few weeks with everything that's going on about how, the people of Israel are like the rakafot, that you don't see them, but suddenly when the state needs them to come and to crawl through the mud, there they are popping up in every hole and in every ditch and under every rock. And suddenly there are rakafot everywhere. One of the ways to get this campaign going, but it has a double meaning, was a song that was written by Naomi Shemer, okay? Waltz Lahaganat HaTeva, the waltz for the protection of nature. I brought you the English translation. Really, go to YouTube and listen to it in Hebrew, but if you want to know what the words mean, it's a very interesting song, because on the one hand, yes, it's about protecting the flowers, but see what else it's about as well. Daffodils are already blooming in the nature reserves. Flower beds spread through the coastal plains. Poppies and saffrons, 1,000 hues and colors. And the law that says picking is forbidden here. Only I am not protected by the law. Only I have no one guarding me. If I had sepals, then my situation would have been different. Rare birds are already nesting in the rocks. Rare trees are kept separately. Frightened deer look at the sign that clearly states the hunting is forbidden. Only I don't have a sign put up for me. Only I don't have a fence around me. If I were, say, a doe, my situation would have been different. Sir, the tulip is not an option. Every tall hill in the outskirts of town is a fenced out and registered wildlife area. So I sometimes think it would have been best if I were a daffodil or a cyclamen or even a common squill. Look at what happens to me on the road. Everyone passes by, grabs, picks, makes a bouquet. If I were an animal or a flower, then my situation would have been different. Okay, Naomi Shemer in 1966. This is Me Too of 1966. And Naomi Shemer is using the flowers to talk about sexual harassment of women, largely in the army, but not only. And it was a song that became a very popular song, even if the message was not always listened to 100%. So she was definitely ahead of her time. Okay, let's talk a little about getting out into nature. Okay? Hiking in Israel is a national ethos, right? Anyone who's been in Israel for the holidays, or Hanukkah or summer vacation knows you gotta go, you gotta make your picnic, you gotta go out there and hike on the trails. That's what people do here. Hey, not that they don't do other things, go to shopping malls, but hiking is a thing that we do, right? Walking the land is a way to own the land. We have an idea in Chazal, right? That you walk four amot in the land of Israel. That's a very important idea. The early pioneers, the early Zionists would go on hikes, often in defiance of the British. This is a picture over here of hiking in the desert on the top left corner. There were places that were considered to be closed areas that the British didn't allow hiking. The youth groups went out. They went out to hike Masada. The Palmach went out to hike, and this was part of their way of claiming the land, of saying we're part of the land. Already in the 1940s, following the, trying to copy an idea from Europe, there was an idea that there should be trail markers, which is very nice and very pleasant. And in the desert, absolutely necessary because these places were not marked. People didn't know where to go. There weren't any places nearby. You could really get lost. Today, there are over 9,500 kilometers of marked trails, largely done by the Society for the Protection of Nature, also done by JNF. They are painted on rocks. Yes, some countries are more sophisticated. My husband went to New Zealand this year. He's like, forget about painting on rocks. They have real signs everywhere that explain everything. So we have painting on rocks. It's not so grand, but it is very helpful. You can go hiking and you can follow the markers everywhere. The paint is actually donated by one of the major paint companies in Israel, the Tambor Paint Company. There are all kinds of trails all over Israel. They are marked by color. And I brought you a picture here of a marker on the Eli Cohen Trail in the Golan, right? Eli Cohen, our man in Damascus, there's a trail that follows events connected to his life and his death. There is a trail, the Jerusalem Trail. There's a trail in the footsteps of the Gospels, Lahavdil. There's a trail in the footsteps of the Sanhedrin. But the most famous trail is the Shvil Yisrael, is the Israel Trail. And if you look at the map over here, you can see that it goes all the way from Tel Dan. This is the beginning by Tel Dan over here. It goes all the way down through some of the most beautiful hiking areas in the country and all the way down to Eilat. It is 1,950 kilometers. It does not include Judea and Samaria. As you can see today, there's a Judea and Samaria trail. This is a trail that tons of people hike. It has the iconic colors you can see over here on the right, white, blue, and orange. White is for the snow of the Hermon. Blue is for the Mediterranean. Orange is for the desert. Depending on which color is on top, right? If the orange is on top, then you are heading south. If the white is on top, then you are heading north. And a whole culture has kind of grown up around the Israel Trail. Kids do it after they finish the army. Groups of retirees go once a month and they do it. There are people who are called angels of the trail, who, if you're doing it straight through, you need places to take a shower or to sleep. There are people who will open up their homes to you so that you have a place to stay. So the Israel Trail is really an amazing phenomenon. People come from other countries to hike it. The idea came from somebody named Avraham Tamir in the 90s. He was inspired by the Appalachian Trail in the US, and it was planned by someone named Uri Dvir, opened in April of 1995, right, after a lot of work, and you can hike it today. Okay, let's talk a little about energy. How's your dude? Okay, a dude is a water tank powered by solar energy. In Israel in the 1950s, there were energy shortages, and so the Jewish brain always has to come up with solutions. And so there was already a version of solar-powered water heaters. In the 1970s, with the oil crisis, somebody named Harry Tavor develops the solar water heater that we are using today. 90% of households in Israel heat their water through solar heat. He came up with the idea to incorporate some black into the panels because that absorbs the heat better. But today, the solar water heaters are ubiquitous, but we are developing more solar energy. We have solar energy centers that research this in Ben Gurion University in the Negev. Of course, the Negev is a major center for solar energy because of all the sun that's there. Also in the Weizmann Institute, there are solar power stations in the Negev to generate electricity. In the picture on the right here, you have a solar field in Kibbutz Keturah, which is all the way down near Eilat. This is the first commercial solar field. It's not something that's just research being done on it. This is from a guy named Yossi Abramowitz, who's developed a whole company to encourage more solar energy. And here we're not only talking about water heaters, we're talking about solar panels that people put on their roofs to generate electricity. This is already being done. It requires a large investment in the beginning, but it eventually pays itself back because you generate more electricity than you can use and you sell it back to the electric company. Solar energy is a perfect fit for Israel because we are in a country with a large amount of sun. Okay? We have 9, 10 months a year where it's sunny pretty much every day. And for the days that it's not, you have an alternative, right? You can heat through other ways, or use electricity through other ways. But Israel, really, solar energy is an ideal clean energy for Israel. One of the other clean energies is more controversial, right? And that's wind energy. Right? Wind turbines, you can see them in various places on the Gilboa Mountains by the Jezreel Valley, but more of them and more in the news in the Golan. Right? The Golan has a number of wind farms, and there are plans to build many more. And there was a whole, I just want to get my numbers correct because I don't remember it. So I'll tell you in a second. Today there are 160 in the Golan. The goal is to ultimately have 220. Right? But in the summer, you might have followed this in the news, there were very violent protests by the Druze community in the Golan. The Druze do not go in for violent protests. This is not something that they do. They usually live very peaceably and quietly in Israel, but they were very, very, very incensed by the plan by a company called Energix to build more wind turbines on Druze land. The company said, "Well, we bought the land." The Druze said, "Not so clear that you bought the land." And in any case, this is disturbing our way of life. And not only the Druze, but a lot of people in the Golan are very opposed to these wind turbines. A good friend of mine, a guide in the Golan, gave me a short, explanation why. Basically, the bottom line is that they produce very, very little energy. You get very little bang for your buck. The companies that are putting them up don't really care because they're getting subsidized by the government. The kibbutzim that they're putting them up on don't really care because they're getting paid. But you have these, first of all, blights on the landscape, and second, real harm being done to birds. And there's a lot of biodiversity and birds in the Golan, and this is a death trap for birds, and you don't get very much. And in fact, they're building them even taller. They're now talking about building wind turbines. The newest ones are going to be 220 meters high. These are huge skyscrapers. And the technology is already beginning to become obsolete. So question is it worthwhile? Is it not worthwhile? It's definitely not as clear as solar energy. Okay, we are going to finish with a few stories of taking lemons and turning them into lemonade. And we're going to start with the Chirya, which today is a beautiful park with incredible views of Tel Aviv. And it's eco-friendly and it's got a gorgeous lake. But of course, it starts out as a garbage dump. Okay, so for those who are not familiar with Chirya is right in the center of everything in Gush Dan, one of the busiest areas of the country, right off of the Ayalon Highway. Right near Holon, Tel Aviv, Ramat Gan, right in the middle of everything. Up until 1948, it was an Arab village called Al-Khiriyah. That's what the name comes from. Khiriyah actually in Arabic means good or fertile. It was very good land, but its earlier name was Ibn Ibrak, which is B'nai Brak, right? We know B'nai Brak, the famous city of the rabbis who are sitting in B'nai Brak having their Passover Seder. This is in this area somewhere. There's been a little bit of archaeology done, but very, very little. In 1948, the Arabs who were living in Khiriyah ran away. And what happened was that in 1951, this became a temporary transit camp, a ma'abara for new immigrants. But in 1952, this started to become the garbage dump for the Tel Aviv area. And as the Tel Aviv area grew bigger and bigger and started to produce more and more and more garbage, this became a massive dump, okay? 60 meters high hill of garbage, all garbage, okay? From 1952 to 1998. By 1998, there are calls to shut it down completely. First of all, smell, right? Air pollution, water pollution, fires from methane gas that was trapped underneath all the garbage, danger because we're right near the airport, and tons of birds were attracted to the garbage and they were causing trouble with flight patterns. So there was a public outcry. 1998, it was shut down. But then the question was, okay, what are we going to do next, right? You have this hill of garbage. What's going to happen? There was a competition, and a German landscape architect named Peter Latz won the competition. And what he did was they covered this mound with a bioplastic layer that blocks the methane. The methane was then later used to create energy. Okay? They topped this with gravel, and they put soil on top, and they turned it into this beautiful park. Now today it's not called Khiriyah anymore. It's called the Ariel Sharon Park because Ariel Sharon very much supported this idea. And ultimately it was named for him. So the idea of turning the garbage dump into a park is amazing enough, but there's another piece to it. And that is that at the bottom of the hill, you have an enormous recycling facility, okay, where tons of garbage trucks are coming, 1,000 garbage trucks a day are coming to Khiriyah, and they are sorted into different facilities. Organic waste is turned into mulch. Non-organic waste is turned into RDF, refuse-derived fuel. Okay? We are turning garbage into energy, and it's really an amazing, amazing thing. So that's Khiriyah. Also has an education center, very worth visiting. Okay. Two final projects, grassroots projects. Okay? The train to Jerusalem, from Jerusalem to Tel Aviv, there was originally a very, very, very slow train that eventually, 1998, was shut down. Today, there's a new high-speed train, but there were these train tracks in southern Jerusalem that were not being used for anything, that were kind of growing over. There was a plan to make the light rail here. And then there was a group of citizens who said, but wait, this is a beautiful, natural area. Why should we pave it over with concrete? Why don't we make it into a park that could be used by different populations in Jerusalem? It runs through a lot of different neighborhoods. Their inspiration was the High Line in New York. In 2008, they pushed and pushed and pushed, and they managed to win. And to create a project that was created between 2010 and 2013. And nobody who comes to Jerusalem now is not aware of this. It's right near all the hotels, the beginning of it, right near Liberty Bell Park. It's a beautiful track with bike paths and walking paths and book stands and benches. And it's used by everybody, right? All sorts of people. Another project, right? If you've been to downtown Jerusalem, you know that there is a very ugly white elephant building called Binyan Klal. It was built after a beautiful building that was a boys' high school of the Alliance Israélite Universelle was destroyed in the name of progress, and they built this indoor mall, which is just an awful building. But instead of calling to tear it down, there were a group of activists who said, but wait, let's see what we can do with it. And they created on the roof a sustainable rooftop which has a plant nursery. It has bees. They grow bees. It has compost. It has a biogas production. You can, they do concerts up there, and it's become this place that people can come and hang out. Beautiful green space. The idea is to create this concept of sustainable green rooftops and to make this as a model to have them in other places around Israel. Okay, we cannot finish today without talking about what's happening in Israel in the past few weeks, which is that volunteers have been showing up in droves at farms all over the country, okay, ever since the war began. Most of the Thai workers who keep the farms going have left. They've gone back to Thailand. Palestinian workers are not allowed in, and farmers are suffering. They don't have anyone to prune, to water, to weed, and most importantly, to bring in the crops because we're in harvest season. And so every day, thousands of volunteers are showing up at farms all over from the areas near the Gaza Strip to other parts of the country and just doing this work. And it's amazing. I've done it a couple of times. It's an incredible thing. And these are all pictures of fellow tour guides, friends of mine, who are out there and they are doing the work of the farmers. Okay, finally. And this is a good coda for our whole course and not just for today. This is an idea from my friend, fellow Torah in Motion teacher, Yael Leibowitz. And she talks about, you know, we started by saying, well, are we disconnected from the land and are we supposed to rule over the land? And she explains that the Torah idea is that the land and the people are connected to each other and they affect one another for bad and for good. If we don't behave properly, we'll be exiled. The land will vomit us out, as the Torah says. If we do behave properly, we will be able to live in harmony with the land. And we have this beautiful verses in the book of Hosea. Right, where Hosea says, when the wayward wife, who's Am Yisrael, right, returns to God, at that point, right, God will answer the sky and the sky will answer the land and everything will live in harmony. And we'll be able to live and flourish on this land. Our job is not to subdue the earth. Our job is to make the earth better. And by doing that, we make ourselves better as well. Let's see the comments that people have. Okay. Yes, Shalom Chanoch, beautiful song, Man Adam Eitz HaSadeh. Yes, another thing to look up. When we lived in New Haven, we paid rainbow recycling, right? Recycling for sure is part of the story, although that's also interesting because some people say also you don't get so much bang for your buck. Today, yeshivas sell land that they do not own. So one can fulfill the mitzvah. Okay, I don't know what that is about, but you could explain. The British didn't ban hunting in the UK till recently, to great distress among landowners. Well, okay, and the British, they're, you know, they're very into their hunting here, less so. Who was hunting pre-1924? People were hunting. First of all, we had Christians who were here. You had people who were hunting not just for food, but for getting rid of pests on the land, okay, or for sport. So it clearly was something that was being done. SPNI is now housing refugees in its field schools. Thank you. I didn't know that. Thank you for that. Trophy hunters. What is Ruth? What is DJ TJ? I don't know what that is. Okay, you'll tell us. What?
Don't worry about it. It's just a political dig, so don't worry.
Oh, okay. Even school kids go. Okay, thank you. Any other comments? No, I think we're good. Anyone else want to add? Engedi water is still sold. I don't know what the compromise they came to, but you definitely still see it in the supermarket.
Okay, can I say something?
Please, Ruchama.
I enjoyed very much every as an Israeli, I was a member of Hevra Le'Haganat HaTeva, and what we used to do is actually I was walking all, not at one time, at all Israel, from the south to the north. And what we used to do is every place that we came, we were sitting and opening the Bible and reading about this place, which was really beautiful. So,
that's what we have to do. That's what we have to do. Everyone has to come back and we will go on a real teal. Thank you. Thank you, everyone who joined for this series. It was really wonderful being with all of you.
Julie, one time I was going to come on your trip, and our daughter-in-law went into labor, and that was in back in May 10th, but we missed it. It was through the tall building, the Pinsker building. They were organizing, couldn't go. They had a baby.
Oh, come another time
in the future, God willing. Yeah, thank you for this. Beautiful.
Yes.
Thing.
Oh, yeah. Lots of good flower songs, by the way. You could make a whole playlist of flower songs.
SP&I is asking for money to help support the refugees in their field schools.
Yeah, so that's beautiful. Thank you for sharing that. I mean, I know so many places have opened up their sites. I didn't know that about SP&I. All right.
Thank you
thank
so
you
much.
Very, thank you, everyone.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Excellent.
Excellent.